Welcome to the audio recording of Magical Child, Rediscovering Nature's Plan for Our Children by Joseph Chilton Pierce. Today's date is Monday, July 30th, 2018, and it's time to dive into this book. We'll read one half of Magical Child's book cover information. The other half is presumably at the very back of the book on archive.org, where this is recorded, where this is being read from. I don't know how to navigate to the very back of the book, so maybe if someone can let me know that, I can edit this video to include the complete reading of the book cover. Magical Child, Joseph Chilton Pierce. Beginning with that first great act of intellect, birth, the human child has only one concern, to learn all that there is to learn from the world that she or he is part of. This planet is the child's playground, and nothing, neither adult values nor concepts of quote, normal, unquote, growth, should interfere with a child's business to play. Raised this way, the magical child is a happy genius, capable of learning anything, even of developing so-called psychic abilities, which we now consider the rare anomaly. In the West, we have traditionally started very early to thwart this wonderful plan of nature. We even turn the act of birth into a trauma. Joseph Chilton Pierce, author of the influential The Crack in the Cosmic Egg, shows in this book that this is only the first of many tragic errors that we make in raising our children. The alarming rise in autism, hyperkinetic behavior, and adolescent suicide are the most extreme examples of the unhappy results of our methods. Pierce contrasts the neurotic and fear-ridden behavior of all too many Western youngsters with the remarkable abilities of Far Eastern and African children. Magical Child. Dedicated to Karen. We have a table of contents with 23 chapters, notes, bibliography, subject bibliography, and index. Here are the acknowledgments. Many people contributed to this work, sending me the majority of the books, research papers, and articles I've used. My sincere thanks to all of them. Thanks to Ralph and Judy Blum, who introduced E.P. Dutton's senior editor, Bill Whitehead, to a sketch of the original material. Sincerest thanks to Bill and to Pat Murray, whose insight penetrated my turgid prose, glimpsed the magical child there, and patiently worked to clarify that glimpse. My thanks to Nancy Brown, who managed the seminars through which the material achieved its synthesis. Thanks to George and Ruth Baratti for my residency at the Montalvo Center for the Arts in Saratoga, California, the shelter under which much of this was written. Thanks to Catherine Barkley, who tempered my extreme judgments and gave insight into motherhood at its finest. Finally, my dedication to Karen Hines speaks of more than thanks. Preface. The material in this book has led me to a position so at odds with current opinion about the child mind and human intelligence that I have been at some loss to bridge the gap. At issue is a biological plan for the growth of intelligence, a genetic encoding within us that we ignore, damage, and even destroy. The mind-brain is designed for astonishing capacities, but its development is based on the infant and child constructing a knowledge of the world as it actually is. Children are unable to construct this foundation because we unknowingly inflict on them an anxiety-conditioned view of the world, as it was unknowingly inflicted on us. The childhood that most experience is a battleground between the biological plan's intent, which drives the child from within, and our anxious intentions, pressing the child from without. Nature has provided that the human child be more dependent on a caretaker for a longer period of time than any other species. If parents and society honored nature's purpose behind this long dependency and slow maturation, the child would discover and respond to the world without concern for the utility or value of his or her discovery. If the child were allowed to develop this natural worldview, logical maturation would develop a utility, value, and ability almost beyond our imagination. Children throughout other parts of the world do, in fact, continually display abilities far beyond our accepted norms, though not for long. I thought at first to write a simple outline of the biological plan as my understanding of it has unfolded over these years, but the material would not let me rest with that. Critical issues tumbled in. What is going so wrong in all technological countries today that infantile autism and brain damage are increasing at an epidemic rate, that childhood suicides are increasing yearly, that growing numbers of parents are beating infants? Remember, this was published in 1977. I think the Western world has come a long way. And tiny children to death, that schooling is becoming increasingly unproductive, traumatic, even hazardous, and improbable to maintain, and so on. I found that none of these problems, isolated to itself, is solvable. And I found that we make a serious error if we think children are only reflecting the tensions of the adult world. Rather, it may be the reverse. The issue is the nature of the child mind, human intelligence, our biological connections with the earth system on which the development of the mind-brain depends. Until this issue is clarified and corrected, our problems can only multiply. After working on this manuscript for a year or so, I felt it would be productive to lecture on the subject to get feedback from parents, teachers, professionals, or whoever might be interested. The lectures grew to 3-day seminars and proved of great value as a source of constant correctives, balancing theory and everyday reality, and providing dozens of research sources that I might otherwise never have found. Above all, these lectures and seminars have given me a near shockwave of profound affirmative response from many different parts of the country to the ideas set forth in this book. As the father of 5 children, as an adult who has a clear recollection of the impressions, states of mind, and expectancies of my own early years, and as a teacher in both college and public school, I had some tangible background to relate to the often abstract studies of the child, the mind-brain, and reality. I was not prepared, though, for what formed as the material broke through to me with connections and meanings I had only dimly suspected. At one point, I felt that the book was impossible for me to do, that the implications were too vast and too sad to articulate. I underwent some depression when I began to see the potential of the child and the monumental tragedy that befalls us anew with each generation. I knew guilt over my own experience as a father and nostalgia over the loss of potential I had once felt so keenly. Only by delving as completely into the material as was possible for me did I finally see why I was not guilty, why none of us is or was, and why blame is largely fruitless. Once I had achieved this insight, the material showed me the extraordinary and profound potential and hope that an understanding of the child's and our own mind-brain holds. Because I am writing this book as a parent to parents, a teacher to teachers, and a human concerned about the reintegration of the self, of self and child, I will avoid as far as possible technical terms or explanations. My sole concern is to outline the biological plan and how it is damaged, and I use any material that is helpful. The work of Jean Piaget, for instance, is one of my foundation blocks, yet I have used his theory and materials selectively, as it aided my purpose. It will take us generations to appreciate the enormous scope of the work of the Swiss biologist turned psychologist. He spent some 45 years observing the growth of intelligence in hundreds of children, and I find his work an invaluable source, guide, and model. It was, in fact, Piaget's concern over so-called magical thinking in children that proved a valuable clue and eventually gave me the title of this work. Yet, I often use his material in ways almost opposite to his own viewpoints. For the sake of brevity, I do so without explanation, argument, or apology, other than right here. As a biologist, Piaget felt that psychology had erred by starting with the grown human and working backward to the child, carrying into research the biases and viewpoints of a mature logic. The end product of a biological organism, he said, is not the best place to start if you want to understand that organism. You must start your research at the beginning of that life and let the creature show you as it grows. Piaget found that the child had to build his or her own intellectual knowledge for interpreting and physically responding to the world. He found the infant driven from within, with a non-volitional intent, to make the necessary physical interactions with the world. Piaget called the results of the child's structure of knowledge. We sometimes refer to this as our worldview, that is, the way the brain organizes its incoming information and makes an intelligent response. Piaget found that the child goes through clear developmental stages in this growth of intelligence, stages that parallel physical growth. He found that the child's brainstem and structure of knowledge undergo specific transitions on a kind of timed maturational basis. At each of these shifts, the brain then possesses its information in new ways and develops new ways for interacting with a larger experience. These shifts of logic, according to Piaget, are genetically determined and occur in all children in the same sequence at about the same age, much as physical growth does, I might add. Many people have argued against this position, particularly in this country, the United States. Jerome Bruner feels that any subject can be taught at almost any time if it is cast in a proper framework, and that the stage-specific nature of learning Piaget outlines is artificially binding. Most educators have followed Bruner and his call for earlier and earlier academic experience and training. The People's Republic of China has been scornful of Piaget, insisting that their children are learning abstract academic subjects very early. But the long-range results of China's recent experiments remain to be seen. In the following pages, I will concern myself with these theories counter to Piaget only as I see them acting against the unfolding of the biological plan, not as they relate to Piaget, whose work will stand on its own merit. Recently, Herman Epstein, the Brandeis University biophysicist, has found evidence of periodic brain growth spurts in all children at about the same stages in their development. At these periods, the brain actually grows new biological materials for learning. These spurts occur roughly every 4 years, all but one coinciding with Piaget's periods of logical transition. Brain growth spurts seem genetically predetermined in the same way that Piaget's developmental stages do, and I take it as obvious that these are all part of an integral genetic coding for the growth of intelligence. The theory of development presented by Piaget and Epstein offers a model in which nearly all of the problems of childhood and eventual adulthood can take on a new meaning. But this is the case only if we take into consideration and go around Piaget's own bias, a point of view that was almost inevitable for a 20th century scientist. The prejudice distinctly qualifying his observations was his attitude toward the characteristic he calls magical thinking. In this, he shared the conventional view of other researchers who refer to the child's wish thinking, fantasizing, or autistic thinking, in the original meaning of that term, as a self-enclosed thought that doesn't bother to check against reality. In brief, magical thinking implies that some connection exists between thought and reality, that thinking enters into and can influence the actual world. Child thought is based on this attitude for the first 7 or 8 years. The central question of psychology's and educational research has been, how can the child be made to attend to reality? Or how can we make the child abandon magical thinking? Each generation uses its children to its own ends, Otto Rank once claimed. And magical thinking has been one of the stumbling blocks to using our children as we would like to in service of our technology. And by using our children, he's referring to the cold societal pragmatic perspective, not we as in you and I. His nature, then, made a monumental error in creating a child who compulsively spends most of his or her time in the apparently non-productive, and even just superficially apparently non-productive, and even seemingly anti-survival activities of fantasy, magical thinking, and play. The implicit, almost axiomatic answer of our whole modern treatment of children has been, yes, nature has apparently so erred, and this is all spoken sarcastically, yes, nature has apparently so erred in spite of the fact that this seems to go against the entire thrust and fabric of evolutionary adaptation and selection. But the child's world has recently been collapsing almost as fast as our adult one. Is it not possible that our ideas of the child and nature are in error instead? What the author is saying here is that if we believe evolution and the presence of physiological, psychological, behavioral patterns that are so fundamental, not conditioned by society, but that fantasizing and imagining and magical thinking, if it's so fundamental to in the development of every single human child on the planet, then it must be necessary, and it's not and it may not be a good thing, a good practice of society to try and stamp it out. Moving forwards. Here, Piaget's primary interest and unconscious bias were in the development of rational scientific thought, the kind of thinking that makes great university material. His brilliant observational analysis of the development of such thinking is of immense worth, but something profoundly significant is missing. Recently, split-brain research has led to a theory of dual functioning of the brain according to left and right hemispheres. Some researchers have decided that Piaget's type of thinking, and therefore his results, stems from left-brain thinking, the ordinary, linear, rational, digital thinking so typical of that century. So a counterswing is now underway to promote the education of the other half of the brain. Our ills, say the leaders of this trend, are due to over-educating the left brain. Thus, schools should incorporate right-brain curricula. I cringe at the thought. What the author is saying here is it's not a solution to institute ever more curricula because there is a fundamental misunderstanding. It may not be simply left brain versus right brain, operational, calculating, language, formulating versus creative, spontaneous, right brain. It's something completely different than that and something quite a bit deeper. The author goes on to say, the clue lies within the child's universal compulsion to play and fantasize. And you can't create a curricula, necessarily, or easily, for play and fantasy. Continuing on, researchers state that the infant makes no random or useless movements. From the beginning, every action has meaning, purpose, and design. In the same way, if all children compulsively spend the bulk of their time in some activity, then that activity must play a major role in genetic organization. Fantasy play and magical thinking cannot be errors of nature or examples of a faulty child logic needing adult correction because no species could survive with such a built-in contradiction. What I have done is to take the liberty of using Piaget's research and terms as a basis for examining the child's experience, but I have included those magical areas found unacceptable to academic thought. Once all aspects of the child's experience are examined as natural and meaningful, Piaget's own developmental theory takes on dimensions far beyond, yet still encompassing, his own interests. Concern for the viewpoints of the various specialists whose domain I encroach upon is theirs, not mine. If I have glossed over some points, ignored minor discrepancies, used or misused materials selectively, so be it. My task has been to sketch the picture of the child's mind and nature's plan for intelligence. This is a large terrain, and discrepancies are probably inevitable. But I stand by my sketch of human intelligence and intend this book to be an aid in the correction of a monstrous misunderstanding. End of the preface.
Welcome to episode 2 of our read along together of The Magical Child, a book by Joseph Chilton Pierce. Let's dive into part 1, The Monstrous Misunderstanding. Chapter 1, Promise Given, Magnificent Heritage. The human mind-brain system is designed for functions radically different from and broader than its current uses. An astonishing capacity for creative power is built into our very genes, ready to unfold. Our innate capacities of mind are nothing less than miraculous, and we are born with a driving intent to express this capacity. From the beginning, nature's emphasis is on the mind-brain. When an infant is born, his or her brain is 1/4 its final mature size, while the body is only 1/20 its final size. The brain is then the most complex organism or organ known to exist in the universe. In this universe, and although research has made impressive and gigantic strides in recent years, the mystery of the mind grows correspondingly deeper and richer. Current opinion suggests that we only use a very small portion of our brain capacity in daily life. This book explores why we fail to utilize our brains fully and what a full utilization might mean for us. We receive continual, if sporadic, reports of brain usage and resulting phenomena that fall outside current notions of human possibility. We tend to dismiss these reports because we have no framework into which to fit them, no criteria for giving them meaning. And not incidentally, this continual stream of excluded phenomena calls our systems of belief into question. The existence of a genetically planned development of the body's physical growth is apparent. We even know how nature programs this growth through DNA genetic encoding. All infants and children of all cultures follow the same pattern of body development and at about the same rate of maturation. Baby teeth, 6-year-old molars, 12-year molars, genital sexuality, and so on appear at about the same time in all countries and among all races. We are not, thank God, responsible for the order or timing of this unfolding. All we are called upon to do is to nurture the genetic plan and not supplant it. This book discusses a corresponding, beautifully coordinated biological plan for the development of intelligence. Indeed, we find that body growth, so self-evident, follows the needs of the mind-brain's development in perfect synchrony. To allow full development of intelligence, we must acknowledge and cooperate with this biological plan. In so doing, we will find that most of our current problems with infants and children will never materialize, for our problems are largely man-made, not caused by nature, but rather caused by ignoring nature's plan. Nature herself worked out all problems aeons ago. Just as no two sets of fingerprints are alike, the genetic plan for the development of intelligence is unique to every human, yet most human infants are born with essentially the same brain mechanisms. Even a large difference in brain size does not fully determine the scope of intelligence. Anatoly France, with his tiny brain case, and Turgenev, with his huge one, are the classical examples. Nature may not endow some few chosen brains with superiority. As we have long thought, a big head doesn't mean a smart one. Back in 1938, for instance, Harold Skeels of the University of Iowa was nearly drummed out of the American Psychological Association, renegade man, for his studies questioning that IQ, the intelligence quotient of a person, was directly related to environmental conditions, particularly the nurturings of home and family. You can imagine at this time there was a huge desire to keep intelligence power related to family encased. And at that time, everyone knew, or at least thought, That intelligence was innate, a fixed genetic factor, that some were just merely born better than others. Everyone was tragically wrong, of course, and eventually Skiles was recognized. Intelligence, like the body, can be injured or nurtured, stimulated or starved. Barriers to intelligence have long since been winnowed out by nature, because nature does not program for failure. Nature programs for success, and has thus built a vast and awesome program for success right into our very genes. Nature also programmed the parent to respond with the precise nurturings needed. Yet what she cannot program is the parental failure to nurture the infant child. Makes sense. Nature programs every new brain system for maximum potential. To say that every child is a potential genius may sound ridiculous and even cruel, but to take current statistical norms as the standard, or to say that what the average child is achieving now is natural for the average child, is far more ridiculous and surely more cruel. Our ancestors have been on this earth for several million years, and even at our appearance here, life had been producing thinking organisms for 3 billion years prior to us. Ours is an astonishing heritage. We contain within our small skulls the culmination of these aeons of slow and steady brain evolution. To understand the nature of the mind-brain, we must first grasp the awesome stretch of time our living Earth has spent in genetic code experimentation, leading to our present state. In her 3 billion year preparation for us, life moved from simple thinking forms to ever more complex ones. This movement still takes place through a slow evolution, working through selection and through quantum jumps of possibility. And in the marvelous economy of nature, nothing is lost. Each progression life makes toward greater intelligence encompasses all previous gains. Our skulls, for instance, contain an old brain and a new brain. Our old brains are made of what is called the reptilian brain and is some 200 to 300 million years old. That is, it was developed and perfected that long ago. And an old mammalian brain that is nearly as ancient. And it is through this system that we inherit the gains of the past. We have as well the new brain, the neocortex. Nature experimented with the size of this new brain time and again before settling on our particular dimensions. We have a far greater amount of this gray matter than lower... Oops. Beep, beep. Than lower, or what are perceived as lower animals. Yet nowhere near so much as the giant whales and some dolphins. The amount of gray matter in our brains is just enough for what we need for certain goals nature has in mind for us. For example, such as our apparent dominion over terrestrial Earth. Furthermore, intelligence is not assigned only to the brain and nervous system. Every cell of our bodies is an intelligence of staggering complexity, and every cell acts intelligently. Every cell acts intelligently. Despite what you may commonly believe, every cell acts intelligently. Continuing on, the mind-brain-body complex is a wonderful array of intelligences ranging from the simpler life forms of the cell and old brain to the most complex, neocortex. Each human being contains patterns of all thinking forms developed over the millennia. There are no limits to the possibilities within genetic coding. Nature can program an indefinite amount of information and ability into a brain system, even quite simple and tiny ones. Consider the homing pigeon, which can find its way back over hundreds of miles. Its tiny brain appears to have a knowledge of the magnetic lines of force surrounding the Earth, and it navigates by means of this built-in knowledge. Eels and salmon can find their way unerringly through thousands of miles of ocean, up hundreds of miles of freshwater streams, to the very brook from which they came as fingerlings. They appear to have a built-in map of the world and an equal ability to chart their course accurately. Most animal species seem to have complex pre-programmed information, such as the monarch butterfly, about the world and how to move successfully in it. All they need at birth is exposure to that world for these innate programs to be quickly activated and brought into play. The result is a rapid autonomy. They mature and can take care of themselves in a very short time. Brain researchers are now beginning to consider the brain as a form of hologram. A hologram is a kind of photography that contains the entire photograph within any part or piece of the whole. You must see this to believe it. There are many uncanny properties of holography, but this phenomenon of the whole within the part is the property that seems similar to the brain. For example, take a hologram plate of a vase of flowers and break that plate in half. You do not have a picture of two halves of a vase. Each half is still in the complete picture. Break the plate into quarters and you will have four complete pictures, and so on, down to the tiniest small fragments. The problem is that the picture gets fuzzier at each reduction. A tiny piece still contains the whole picture, but the clarity is gone. And when we speak of the brain as a hologram, we mean that any part of the brain, even a single thinking cell, reflects or encompasses the workings of the total brain. An even more intriguing implication is that the brain may be a hologram of the entire planet Earth. That is, just as you can divide a holographic plate and find the whole picture in any piece, so the brain can be considered just such a piece of the Earth, reflecting within it the picture or workings of the whole life system. The human brain may be a kind of micro-miniature replica of the living planet herself, just rather fuzzy at the edges, needing clarification. The model of the brain as hologram automatically implies a further extension of the hologram notion. The brain may be a hologram of the planet, but the planet itself may be then a hologram. Indeed, just this model has been suggested by some of our greatest brain researchers. Look up reference number 3. So to use this model, we can consider our brain species pieces of the Earth hologram just as in any and all parts of the Earth are pieces of a greater hologram. This is something that mystics and poets have alluded to down through the ages, as when William Blake wrote, "To see the world in a grain of sand." At birth, the brain, as a hologram fragment, must have exposure to and interact with the Earth hologram to achieve clarity, to bring the brain's picture into focus, so to speak. Confine a newly born brain and prevent interaction with the Earth and no clarification can take place. That creature will be retarded in its development and helpless. If a kitten spends his first few critical weeks of development in a compartment with vertically striped walls, the grown cat will be able to see only those objects of a vertical stature. See reference number 4. He will avoid the legs of a chair perfectly well, but will run smack into the horizontal rungs. Interesting study. The speed and efficiency with which the newborn brain hologram achieves its clarity by interaction with the Earth hologram depends upon how extensive a reflection of the total Earth hologram that brain contains. Those brains reflecting highly specific aspects of the Earth, such as the brain of a homing pigeon or bee, achieve very rapid autonomy. The greater the potential content of the brain hologram, the slower the process of clarification. The brain achieves its clarity of operations only through interacting with or moving into physical touch, physical sensation with the living Earth itself, which is to say that the hologram, beep, beep, boop, boop, reboot, which is to say that the hologram fragment achieves its clarity by interacting with the total hologram. To the extent the newborn is allowed interaction with the Earth and its surroundings, to that extent, the brain clarifies its own portion of the picture. Life has moved from simple to ever more complex thinking forms. To use our hologram model as I shall throughout, I would say that life has moved from highly specific and limited, thus simpler, holograms, to ever more complete and complex ones. Nature could program an infinite amount of information and ability into a brain system, but she is selective in the particular nature of any hologram brain. The homing pigeon has marvelous capacities, but it is only a narrow fragment of the total Earth picture. Eels and salmon have a marvelous navigation, but are, after all, not very adaptable or flexible. We can easily figure out their particular programming, predict the journey built into their world map, set up nets, and wipe them out. Unfortunately, that is true. Nature programs according to an intricate ecological balance. Each bit of the hologram system interacts with the total for precise functions. Each hologram piece interacts with the total for precise functions. Every creature fits into the balance with meaning, purpose, and design. Life appears to keep many of her experimental creatures if they fit this balance successfully. Others she discards as she moves on towards certain goals. In moving from simpler to more complex forms, life created an interacting system of stability, yet continued moving toward more advanced brains or more complete holograms of her total experience. Of course, her total always includes the interacting balance of all the life forms. She builds in a capacity for the clarifying of her ever more extensive and complete holograms through an ever more extensive capacity for physical interaction with the total. In moving from simpler to more complex thinking organs, life's growth has been toward a more open intelligence and a more flexible logic. The more open the intelligence, the greater the totality of the Earth that the hologram can express. Furthermore, an open intelligence is one that can structure a knowledge of an increasing amount of experience and compute the widening range of information gained by that experience. By flexible logic, I mean a brain system that can differentiate between its experiences, combine them as well, and synthesize new ways to interact with ever more complex kinds of experience. Boop, boop. Beep, beep. Open intelligence and flexible logic combine so that the more we learn through personal experience, the more we can learn. The more phenomena and events with which we interact, the greater our ability for more complex interactions. And the design of nature and the combination of an open intelligence and flexible logic is to get beyond the specific limitations of the Earth hologram itself, that is, in the human system, life has evolved a way for getting beyond the restrictions of holograms in general. What this means is the subject of the rest of this book. Each animal species is able to interact with the Earth within certain strict limits. Lower brains are not holograms of the whole Earth, only certain aspects of that Earth. The simpler the brain, the more specific its programming, and the more readily it can efficiently and autonomously interact with the Earth. The newborn baby chick can immediately recognize and peck at seeds of the proper shape and size. The frog sees only these movements in his environment that relate to his food supply and or safety. The larger and more elaborate the brain, the wider the hologram effect of that species, and the greater its intelligence or ability to interact. And as stated, the longer it takes to develop that ability. As we move up the evolutionary scale, we find not only larger old brains carrying larger portions of the Earth hologram, but also the so-called silent areas of the brain, a new kind of brain matter that does not seem to be a pre-programmed part of the hologram. This new brain material, the neocortex, is the computer part of the brain. It appears to be able to solve problems that cannot be programmed as fixed information. Or perhaps, rather than computer, this might be better stated as our intelligence, as in artificial intelligence, but organic intelligence. Because it appears to be able to solve problems that cannot be pre-programmed as fixed information. This is the part of the brain that develops logic. The higher apes have more of this new brain material than lower animals and prove able to learn more and even interact creatively. Recently, remember this book was published in 1977, several chimpanzees were taught to read and make sentences. Even so, much of their brain is programmed for specific interactions with the earth and needs only the briefest exposure to that earth for the programs to be fully activated. This gives quick autonomy but limited capacities. Human infants have a long, slow development of autonomy. They are more helpless for a longer period of time than infants of any other species on the planet. There are two reasons for this that the author knows of, and these will prove decisive in responding to the child appropriately. First, within the older brain systems, we almost surely carry the information and ability acquired through all the Earth's history. This pre-programming encompasses the total life hologram and its knowledge. The vastness of this programming means that none of its information is specific. Human infants are not limited to certain parts of the Earth to activate their programming. The Eskimo, in his environment of ice and snow, can achieve as full an intellectual development as the Balinese or Australian can in their strikingly different worlds. Lack of specificity means that autonomy, that combination of knowledge and ability, takes quite a long time to develop. Second, there is a striking difference between the older genetically programmed brain systems and the new unprogrammed brain, and in this difference lies the resolution of the long argument concerning nature versus nurture, which is an argument about whether we have information built in or whether we must acquire all of our information from our environment or through nurturing. One school of thought argues that the prolonged helplessness of the infant child permits the child to be taught our cumulative social knowledge, lest he remain animal-like. However, this position is no longer tenable. The reason for the long period of dependency and helplessness is that the infant child must structure his or her own knowledge of the world, and she or he must do this almost from scratch. Paradoxically, the infant is born into this world with a brain system that may be a hologram of the entire Earth system. The paradox is resolved when we consider that it is the old brain system with its reptilian and old mammalian brains that represents the life hologram. The new brain, the infant's future supercomputer, is the blank slate. Were we to operate entirely out of the old brain system, as indeed we do at first, we would be as purely instinctive as the lower species. We would have neither an open intelligence nor a flexible logic. We would have no creativity, no individual personality. Our old brain hologram is of such vast dimensions that its outlines are fuzzy, undifferentiated, and non-specific. Any specifics from this total must be slowly brought into play through physical interaction. The whole riddle of development and the vast difference between man and animal center on the method of articulation or clarification of the potential carried in the old brain system. And perhaps the vast differences between man and animal are not as different as we assume. That's my little addition. But moving forward with the book, what happens in brief is that the old brain's hologram content is only in potentia and must be structured as actual workable knowledge in the new brain system, which will become the decision-making computer area. In the old brain, such knowledge would lead only to a reflexive, instinctual pattern of action. But when it is translated as structured knowledge in the new brain, we develop conscious and flexible action with eventual creativity, not necessarily all knee-jerk reaction, but the ability to process. Moving forward, the transfer from old brain potential to new brain actuality takes place through an infant child's muscular body movements. The older brain systems run the physical body, dictating or activating the actual movements of the child. The opening stages of the biological plan rest entirely on a pre-programmed plan for moving that infant child's body in a prescribed manner. These early body movements impel, literally drive, or propel the child into physical interactions with whatever material substance of this earth is available to him or her at that time, and equally into the physical principles, the laws of cause and effect, by which this earth operates. These physical interactions with the world bring about a simultaneous patterning of that particular experience in the infant child's new brain system. Thus, the child's knowledge structure builds out of almost infinitely varied possibilities, yet proves to be a knowledge of the living earth as it actually operates. Then, through a marvelous function of logical feedback, that computer brain system develops volitional control over the knowledge structured, develops the ability to decide freely between alternatives for interaction, develops the ability to interact creatively with the world through the structure of knowledge built up about that world, and eventually can even transform parts of the world itself as needed for security and well-being. Jerome Bruner observed that the infant child's intent precedes the ability to do. Every infant and child shows an intent to perform some act, such as talking or walking or sitting up, basically play talking, trying to walk or trying to sit up, long before she or he can actually accomplish it. The infant in the crib makes clumsy, jerking thrusts toward an object long before she or he succeeds, finally, in correctly aiming toward and grasping that object. She or he makes preliminary gestures toward turning over long before he or she succeeds in doing so. She or he starts trying to sit up before she or he actually can. It's easy enough to observe this intent, so crude in its initial movements, but where does it come from? It does not come from imitation. The infant child might observe the parent sitting up, walking, and so on, but the child does not observe all the preliminary movements that she or he must go through to accomplish that act. Furthermore, the blind child, for whom visual imitation is not possible, will show the same rough gestures of intent. What propels that infant body to make those movements? Instincts, we say. But what is an instinct? An instinct is some non-volitional reflexive action that operates largely autonomously, that is, without volitional prompting. Sucking on a nipple is such a built-in action. Now, surely, intent operates as an instinct, and surely it arises from the old brain system, possibly from the cerebellum, a large organ that seems to be involved in body movement. But intent differs from instinct in that it is translated into volitional conscious activity generated from the computer areas of the brain. The adults move through our own volition. We decide to move, walk, or whatever, and our body knowing just does it for us. Such volitional action almost surely comes from new brain decisions or acts in conjunction with older brain functions controlling the body. But this is not the case with the infant or child. She or he has no volition. The child, infant, has only intent. And this intent comes from older brain processes. The surprising and disturbing fact about the early child is that for the first 3 years or so, she or he has no volitional control, no will in the adult sense. The child is moved by his or her intent, much as a puppet is moved by its strings. Intent, arising from programmed, automatic old brain controls, literally impels that body interaction with the physical world. The early child cannot knowingly disobey a parent or willfully misbehave. The early child can only obey the inborn intent that moves him or her. The intent to do has little or no content. That is, intent contains nothing specific, no actual concrete knowledge. The intent is simply an impulse that moves the child's body in its initial crude attempts to interact with the actual world. These body movements and the sensory experiences accompanying or resulting from them are recorded, for lack of a better term, in the form of patterns or tracings of action within the rhythmic patterns in the new brain's thinking cells. To put it crudely, when the nursing infant reaches up and touches the mother's face, the resulting sensory information etches into etches into the new brain in coordination with the particular body movements giving that kind of information. The attempt to sit up makes an attempted pattern in the new brain. Through his or her repeated efforts, the infant's intent etches like waves of light going off, and those lights becoming brighter and brighter. The infant's intent etches in these brain patterns more securely. The rhythmic patterning carrying that kind of information and coordination gets smoother, and the body's responses grow correspondingly smoother and surer. And when sitting up is complete or successful, the pattern is complete and successful. The intent that drives the child for the first few years is that of physical interaction with all the possible contents of the living earth, its creatures, phenomena, experiences, and things, and above all, its principles and laws of interaction. These principles are quite practical and mundane, such as, quote, fall down, go boom, and fire means burn. Each physical contact the child makes brings about a corresponding patterning or learning in his or her new brain. These patterns and the relationships between them that are made through regulatory feedback then grow the child's structure of knowledge, or the child's worldview. The story of development for the first 4 or 5 years is the structuring of these brain patterns from sensory experience and the resulting feedback and synthesis that take place within the brain. Development is the interaction of the intent within and the content without. Intent moves the child toward interaction with content out there. The intent within must always be given its content from without. The more extensive and complete the child's interaction with the content of the world out there, the more extensive the resulting structure of the knowledge within. The greater the structure, greater the possibilities for internal feedback, synthesis, and volitional control, and so the greater the child's ability to interact with more content from without. Through logical feedback, the child eventually develops volitional control over his or her own activities, and later on in life, even volitional control over his or her own brain activities. Think of people meditating to achieve certain brainwave states like theta. And as you fall asleep, consciously bringing your mind from alpha or beta states into more relaxed and aware states of consciousness in preparation for sleep. Moving forward with the book, intelligence is the ability to interact, and this ability can grow only by interacting with new phenomena. That is, by moving from that which is known into that which is not known. Although this seems obvious, this movement from the known to the unknown proves to be both the key and the stumbling block to development. Most intellectual crippling comes from the failure to observe the balance of this movement. In our anxieties, we fail to allow the child a continual interaction with the phenomena of this earth on a full dimensional level, which means with all 5 of his or her body senses. And at the same time, we rush the child into contact with phenomena not appropriate to his or her stage of biological development. That is, either we block the child's movement into the unknown and so block intellectual growth, or we propel the child into inappropriate experience. This is truly a shame that needs to be brought to light. Moving forward with the audiobook recording. From birth, the growth of intelligence is a progression from the concrete toward the abstract. By concrete, I mean the physical substance of this living earth, its rocks, trees, people, winds, and things, and its principles, such as fall down, go boom, and fire means burn. By this world being abstract, on the other hand, I mean the products of the mind-brain's own creativity, one's thoughts and ideas, rather than the actual material stuff of the earth. Just as evolution has been a movement toward more complex thinking forms, the growth of thinking is a movement from concrete thought, knowledge of, and ability to respond to the physical events of the earth, toward purely abstract phenomena, the thoughts occurring within the mind-brain itself.
All thinking arises out of concreteness, which means out of the brain patterns resulting from actual body movements of interacting with actual things. But thinking then moves towards autonomy, that is, moves toward independence of those concrete patterns or physical principles. This progression toward pure thought is itself genetically programmed and unfolds in neat sequential stages. To nurture intelligence in the young is to honor this progression from concreteness toward abstraction. This means that intelligence must first be educated in an accurate and full interaction with the earth as it is, in order that the mind-brain might structure a knowledge of this earth. This is physical knowledge, or basic body knowing. Only out of this kind of knowing can abstract thought develop, such as an understanding of the law of gravity rather than fall down, go boom, or the laws of thermodynamics rather than hot, don't touch. Flexible logic depends on the ability to differentiate between experiences and then group them into useful categories. This differentiation begins quite early in life and is the function of regulatory feedback. One automatic and natural result of this differentiation is the development of a conscious personal awareness, a sense of individuality. This leads to a concern for physical welfare, that you are an individual that is qualitatively different from that of the more undifferentiated mind brains of lower species. Therefore, a method or procedure for protection of our physical body must automatically be a part of the development of intelligence of the mind. Oops. Beep boop. If the mind is eventually to move beyond concrete concerns, that is, to move from concreteness towards abstraction, concrete concerns such as physical safety must be accomplished and gotten behind one. The same qualification holds for the development of personality itself, which is also an automatic result of the logic of differentiation. We hear that the human is the only creature who seems to know she or he must die. The same logic of differentiation that gives us our individual consciousness leads us toward our awareness of personal death. If not met with appropriate content and abilities, this awareness would lead to an anxiety blocking further movement into pure abstraction. But life would not have spent such an astonishingly long period of time developing a logic that in turn develops individuality and awareness of death as a personal only to the mocking the resulting individual with his or her mortality. Rather, the movement for a logic of survival through adaptability has led to the creation of both individual consciousness and the means for a survival of that consciousness. Anything less would be a contradiction of terms within the evolution of intelligence. There are three levels of adaptability and survival, and the means for these unfold sequentially in the biological plan. Physical survival unfolds through creative interactions with the world. Species survival unfolds through genital sexuality. And personal survival unfolds through the development of pure abstract thought. For quite a while now, academic thought has insisted that nature bred our hairless, vulnerable bodies, perhaps accidentally, and that the vulnerability forced us to evolve our great brain system in order to make tools to protect our vulnerable bodies. This belief is so ingrained that we actually believe that only through tools, houses, clothes, weapons, machinery, writing, books, only through these tools, it was believed we can survive. We assume that tool usage is the hallmark of intelligence and set up tool capacity, including writing as a tool, as the final criteria for intelligence. We mold young minds accordingly, centering the training of children on tool usage and the complex abstract systems we have evolved out of such usage. Finally, we conclude that without this engineered tinkering with the mind of the early child, that the child would be as a beast of the field, without language, thought, writing, or horrors, without tools. The extent of this error will occupy this book,
But in no way am I going to attack the technological achievements. In no way would I call, even if I could, for a return to the forest's primeval. The human was not meant to live in the wilderness, in the author's opinion. But on the other hand, the current breakdown of social life clearly shows that we were not meant to live in the strange nightmare world of a city. Humans are designed to live in the garden. To live in the garden, we must tend that garden. We must be good stewards of our resources and exercise careful dominion over them. Tools would be an adjunct to the stewardship over the earth. We get in serious difficulties when we substitute mechanics for personal power, for they are qualitatively different functions. Nikos Tinbergen devoted two-thirds of his 1973 Nobel Laureate speech to the epidemic increase in infantile autism, an epidemic breaking out in all the technological countries of the world. Autism is the cruelest and most nearly hopeless of all childhood psychoses, although it is hardly even in the simple category of a psychosis. Child schizophrenia is also on the rise, as are silent crib deaths, brain damage, hyperactivity dysfunction, mental retardation, and learning disabilities. Nor are we just making better diagnoses. The number of damaged children is rapidly increasing all about us. Achievement scoring in American schools has been on a sharp decline for a decade. Within the short period from 1974 to 76, structure and discipline within the schools have suffered a sharp, decided decline. Teachers of a long and successful standing are folding up physically and mentally, unable to cope with the random meaninglessness of being a teacher. And even more tragic, suicides committed by children under 14 years of age have increased many hundreds of times in the past 15 years. And now we have new and strange breakdown of the body's metabolism called anorexia nervosa, which strikes down teenagers, particularly girls. Our children have been signaling to us for years that things are critically wrong for them. In our anxiety-ridden concern to, quote, equip them fully for life, unquote, we have been deaf and blind to their distress calls, to their needs. And now our training techniques, our teaching systems, our behavior modifications and motivations are turning into chaos, both for our children and for ourselves. Perhaps at this critical point for the survival of the species, we can do more than make another futile gesture toward patching up the holes in our exhausted system of ideas. Perhaps we can seize this cubic centimeter of chance that history is giving us and move, not just to correct some of the more blatant and tragic errors that we have made with children, not just to curb the battered child syndrome, but actually turn again to that 3 billion year development lying within us, within our genes, the uncanny wisdom of the body clearly programmed into the child as unbending intent. In learning to learn again, we can learn of this wisdom and allow our children, and so ourselves, to become the free, whole individuals this good earth has prepared us to be. End of chapter 1. The Promise Given. Moving into chapter 2 of part 1, we have matrix shifts. Known to unknown. Matrix is the Latin word for womb. From that word, we get the words matter, material, mater, mother, and so on. These refer to the basic stuff, the physical substance, out of which life is derived. The womb offers three things to a newly forming life: a source of possibility, a source of energy to explore that possibility, and finally, a safe space within which that exploration can take place. Whenever these three needs are met, we have a matrix, and the growth of intelligence takes place by utilizing the energy given to explore the possibilities given while standing in a safe space provided by the matrix. A matrix is always essentially female by nature. The male sperm must quickly find refuge in the female egg or perish.
The egg matrix is given the energy, possibility, and safe space of the womb matrix within the mother matrix, who stands within the earth matrix itself. After an infant is born from the womb, the mother becomes the source of energy, the possibility, and the safe place on which to stand, so mother rightly means matrix. Later in development, the earth itself should become the matrix, and we have always referred to Mother Earth. Nature was always considered the general spirit of the earth's life and was called Mother Nature, and is another layer of the matrix. The biological plan for the development of intelligence is based on a series of matrix formations and shifts. That is, human beings are designed to grow in intelligence by learning about and gaining ability to interact with one source of energy, possibility, and security after another. The sequence is from early concrete matrices to ever more abstract ones and larger ones, that is, for the matrix of our given life substance to the matrix of pure creative thought. Each matrix shift propels us into another set of unknown, unpredictable experiences, which is the way intelligence grows. Each matrix shift is both a kind of birth, because we move into greater possibilities, and a kind of death, because the old matrix must be given up in order to move into the new. These matrix shifts follow a set cycle. First, the mind brain must structure its knowledge of its matrix. This structuring has its own cycle of competence, or pattern of growth, which I will discuss in Chapter 9, and is accomplished through sensory interaction with the actual content and possibilities of that matrix. The matrix always furnishes the energy necessary for this exploration, and the matrix is, of course, the safe place or protective environment in which the exploration can take place. For instance, the infant in utero The matrix always furnishes the energy necessary for this exploration, and the matrix is, of course, the safe place or protective environment in which the exploration takes place. For instance, the infant in utero structures a knowledge of the womb world even as the body and brain are structured. Physical and intellectual growth are designed as a perfect synchrony. Second, the mind-brain develops bonds, forms of communication and rapport with both its present matrix and the new matrix into which the child must eventually shift as genetic maturation unfolds. Think about it. For example, as a baby is moving around in the womb, it's kicking and hearing mom and dad and the outside world noises, and gathering information slowly about the next matrix to come. Continuing with the book. While in utero, the infant prepares for his or her eventual separation from the womb by establishing bonds of communication with the mother. These bonds are probably partly hormonal, as well as psychobiological and below ordinary consciousness. This bonding process provides a bridge between matrices, the womb and the mother, so that the unknown of the new matrix will have sufficient points of similarity with the known of the old matrix. Then the mind-brain can accommodate or learn about and adapt to the new. Nature would never, of her own choice, propel the child into a new matrix without sufficient preparation, because she or he would be unable to adapt or survive in the new. And remember that nature programs entirely for success. Third, in talking about the matrix shifts showing a set cycle, we have structured a knowledge of the matrix. Once we have structured a knowledge of the matrix, we can move successfully within it and have established bondings with the new matrix. We can shift functionally from dependence on the known matrix and move into the next stage of development, the next matrix. We move into the new matrix only by standing on the old matrix, so to speak. For instance, the early child can move into an exploration of the world only by standing on the safe place provided by the mother. Later, after age 7, the child can move into the matrix of his or her own personal power only by standing on the safe place of the earth itself. Fourth, having shifted matrices, we then have the possibility of a wider, more creative relationship with the former matrix. We find, only after leaving a matrix, that we do not lose the matrix, but are able to interact with it in a far more flexible and in far more creative ways. So long as the infant is in utero, she or he is only a symbiotic extension of the mother. A flexible, creative relationship is not possible, only a relationship of total dependence. To relate creatively and so explore all possibilities, independence from the matrix must be achieved. To relate fully with the mother, the infant must leave the womb and eventually the dependency relation with the mother. After age 7, to relate fully with the world, the child must functionally separate from that world. And by functionally separate, I mean within the brain's processing of information. Each matrix is encompassed within the next matrix and thereby takes on greater possibilities. Biologically, we are supported at each matrix shift with enhanced physical ability, a spurt of new brain growth that prepares us for new learning, and specific shifts of the brain's ways of processing information. Furthermore, intent always precedes the ability to do, that is, during any during any particular state of development, nature is preparing us for the next stage. Yet the beauty of the system is that we are conscious of none of this. All we must do is fully accept and exist within our developmental stage and respond fully to its content. This means that every stage of development is complete and perfect within itself. The 3-year-old is not an incomplete 5-year-old. The child is not an incomplete adult. Never are we simply on our way. Always we have arrived. Paradoxically, of course, the child certainly is an incomplete adult, and we do exist in a flow in which nothing can remain stationary. Everything is only preparatory to something else that is in formation, as day must fade to night and night to day. But all this is part of an infinitely contingent natural system that simply lies beyond our conscious grasp and is, in effect, none of our business. The intricacies of the 3-billion-year system are not necessarily available to us or needed by our short-term understanding. The progression of matrix shifts is from concreteness toward abstraction, or from the purely physical world of the womb, mother, earth, and body, to the purely mental world of thought itself. The cycle unfolds according to a genetic timetable that is roughly the same in all cultures. Variations do occur in timing, but never in the sequence of progressions. That is, maturity can be somewhat speeded up, as it is among the pygmies, or slowed down, but the stages of maturation cannot be skipped or mixed up out of order, at least not without lots of troublemaking. Just as baby teeth come before giant 12-year molars, so do all the ramifications of concrete thought and experience must mature before abstract thought and experience can unfold. We can force certain forms of abstraction prematurely on the child in his or her concrete stage of development, but the effects are specifically damaging, even though the damage will not be detectable for several years. That sounds kind of scary. The cycle of growth unfolds automatically, rather, as though there are so many spins around the sun, and lo, the next set of molars appears, the next brain growth spurt takes place, logical processing shifts, and we move into the next matrix. Apparently, this time sequence is a kind of statistical probability worked out by nature over the millennia. The infant in utero requires about 9 months, give or take a bit, to be ready for a matrix shift. Newborn infant requires about 8 or 9 months
to structure a knowledge of the new mother as a new matrix and to move out to explore the larger matrix, Earth. The child requires about 7 years to structure a knowledge of the Earth matrix and shift from mother as safe space to Earth itself, and so on. What the biological plan does not, and apparently cannot, take into consideration is the failure of development within any particular stage. That next stage unfolds regardless. Baby teeth arrive pretty much on schedule, as do 6-year molars and so on. This physical timing is not dependent on diet or the good graces of a dentist or dental hygiene, although the quality or efficiency of those teeth might well be. Genital sexuality unfolds around adolescence, whether or not the young person, or God knows the parents, is prepared for that unfolding. In the same way, matrix shifts take place automatically, whether or not a proper response and structuring has taken place to adequately prepare the individual for that shift. For instance, if the mother's body is producing massive amounts of adrenal steroids during pregnancy, if you're very adrenalized or stressed out, as a result of chronic anxiety, maltreatment, or fear, the infant in the womb automatically shares in these stress hormones. So pregnant mamas gotta relax, because those adrenal steroids pass right through the placenta. That infant is locked into a free-floating anxiety, a kind of permanent body stress. If you have ever undergone a fright that startles your entire body, you know the body feeling of this stress state. Consider then having just such a flooding of fear without any conceivable reason for it. That is what a free-floating anxiety is. Locked into this tension, the infant in utero cannot develop intellectually or establish the bonding with the mother in preparation for birth. However, nature cannot program for this variable and wait for the damaging effects of chronic stress to be removed. Growth, at least physical growth, grows right ahead, while intellectual growth struggles along as best it can in its crippled state, slipping farther and farther behind. If the infant does not spontaneously abort, it will be born deficient in intelligence, if not in body development, physical development. And this child is highly prone, or at least statistically more likely to be, there's a higher risk factor, of infantile autism or childhood schizophrenia, or dysfunctional in a wide variety of ways. At best, the child will have to use its intelligence to try to compensate for its deficiencies. The timed unfolding goes right ahead, and the child's deficiencies, perhaps physical, accumulate. The greater the deficiencies, the more stringently the system must compensate. Making up means remaining behind, trying to get the basic pattern together. But meanwhile, the wheels roll on, the intelligence, meant to be fully absorbed in the present and adapting to it, is back somewhere trying to get the machine working. If the first matrix formation is incomplete or sufficient, the next matrix formation will be doubly difficult. The young life is more and more jeopardized because the shifts of matrices must take place automatically. Bear this in mind in Chapter 6, when I discuss childbirth as the most critical of all human events. Wow! The moment of delivery. That sounds amazing. Moving forward. Intelligence is the ability to interact with one's matrix. Interaction means a dynamic interchange of energy. The design of nature is what we interact with. The design of nature is that we interact with our matrix in order to interchange our energy and possibility with that of the matrix, which automatically increases and enhances our safe place on which to stand. At conception, the human organism is microscopic. But given the safe place for growth, the vast possibilities of the huge womb world, and the great energies of the mother's body to call on, that tiny organism grows at an astonishing rate. Its energy and life interchange and flow with the energy and life of its matrix and are amplified in so doing. The tiny creature gestures with its energy to its matrix, and its matrix gestures back with greatly expanded energies. The tiny body sows a wind and reaps a whirlwind.
finds itself magnified thousands of times in its own energy, possibility, and security. This interaction is the growth of intelligence and body, and is the pattern of our entire, and it, and this is the pattern our entire life should follow. I'll read that one last time. The tiny body sows a wind and reaps a whirlwind, finds itself magnified thousands of times in its own energy, possibility, and security. This interaction is the growth of intelligence and body, and is the pattern our entire life should follow. At the appointed time, when a knowledge of the matrix is completed, that new creature triggers into motion its own exodus, and from that matrix moves into the infinitely larger matrix of the mother itself. At each matrix stage, life provides that our gestures be reflected back to us by the vastly greater gestures of the matrix. The overall design is open-ended and is limited only by the individual's capacity for interaction, never by the possibilities for interaction. By its very structure, the brain's capacity for concept structuring and synthesizing can never be exhausted, and our independence and capacity of mind, designed to grow from that brain capacity, can only add to and go beyond this flexibility and freedom. In the chapters to follow, I will trace the 5 matrix shifts that take place in the developmental years and some of the ways our proper maturation fails to take place. I have already offered a sketch of life in the womb as first matrix and of the shift from the womb to mother at birth. Research shows that the mother is the infant child's basis for exploration of the world itself. The reason for the child's total dependency on the parent for so long does not lie with just psychological, emotional, or sentimental causes, nor with anxiety over survival, but rather it lies with specific biological functions in the brain system and actual intelligent development. Physical interaction with the mother, or the permanent caretaker if there isn't a mother available, furnishes the infant with his or her basic set of brain patterns through which sensory information can be organized into perceptions. The mother is the infant's world, hologram, the content for his or her intent. She is the infant's power, possibility, and safe space. Or, if the caretaker is a male, he is the infant's power, possibility, and safe space. The biological plan provides that the infant be given exactly the kinds of sensory motor tools or physical capacities needed to do one thing in the first 8 to 10 months of life. That one thing is to structure a knowledge of that caretaker or that mother as the matrix. Once this critical task is accomplished, nature provides that the infant be given the physical and mental tools necessary to move slowly from that mother and explore the living world around him or her. The infant can do this fully and successfully only to the extent the mother is his or her absolutely unquestioned safe space to which the baby can always instantly return to be nourished. Only when the infant knows that the mother matrix will not abandon him or her can that infant move into childhood with confidence and with power. The biological plan provides that the child remains squarely rooted to the mother while the child explores and structures a knowledge of the earth matrix. This worldview structuring takes some 7 years to perfect. When a knowledge of the earth matrix is completed at around age 7, nature provides that the child functionally separate through a division of labor in the mind-brain system from direct dependence on the mother as the base of exploration and shift to the mother Earth itself as the safe place to stand. The Earth, structured as primary knowing structure in the brain, then becomes the source of power and possibility as well. Development then moves towards structuring a knowledge of personal power in interacting with that world matrix. From the years 7 to 11, roughly, the child structures a knowledge of this personal power in the world. This knowledge of the self, one's mind-brain-body complex, As matrix grows through the child's physical interactions with the physical body of the earth, much as the early infant structured a knowledge of the mother through sensory interactions with her, and dramatic and profound new models of interaction unfold for development during this late childhood period. Autonomy, becoming physically independent of parental help and learning to physically survive the principles of the physical world, is the goal of that period. Development of this personal power prepares for a shift of matrix from earth to self. By adolescence, the biological plan is that we become our own matrix, consisting of mind, brain, and body. In the logic of differentiation, mind-brain activity slowly distinguishes from body activity or body knowing, that concrete knowledge structured throughout childhood. The biological plan then drives us toward the fifth matrix shift, when mind-brain should functionally, through distinctions of brain processing, separate from the body. Standing on the matrix of the concretely oriented physical body, mind-brain interactions, pure abstract thinking, should begin matrix formation. That is, the mind-brain should eventually become its own matrix, its own source of power, possibility, and safe place to stand. At some point after maturity, mind should begin a functional separation or logical differentiation from brain processes. This is the final matrix shift that we can have any direct knowledge about. At that point, mind is capable of operating on the structures within its own brain and restructuring its experienced reality accordingly. At that point, personal awareness is no longer contingent upon or dependent upon any concreteness. Thus, the progression from concreteness toward abstraction would be complete. So long as we live, or she lives, the physical mother remains the primary matrix, even though we separate from her and move into larger matrices. Boop, boop. And move into larger matrices. Throughout our lives, the earth remains the matrix of all matrices. No matter how abstract our explorations of pure thought and creative reality, the mind draws its energy from the brain, which draws its energy from the body matrix, which draws its energy from the earth matrix herself. The entire progression can be seen as the growth or development of autonomy, both as a physical organism in the physical world and as a personality in the realm of thought. We have, in effect, only two matrices, the physical matrix progressing from womb, mother, earth, and physical body, and the abstract matrix of thought, progressing from relationships, the ability for interaction. This interacting ability moved through the physical matrices of womb, mother, earth, body, to the abstract matrices of mind-brain with other mind-brains, mind with other minds, and finally, I suppose, mind with mind at large. To use Aldous Huxley's phrase, separation from any matrix is a birth process, and so we find our entire lives a series of births. This process completes its thrust toward abstraction only at death, of course, when all concreteness is transcended, but such remains speculation. Nature has programmed every conceivable safeguard into the biological plan. The execution of her plan is, sadly, highly problematic and subject to disaster because it can only be built in as intent. The success of the plan hinges directly on the infant child's being provided with a content proper for that intent. A proper content is one appropriate to a particular stage of the child's development. The biological plan is wrecked when the intent of nature is met, not with appropriate content, but with the intentions of an anxiety-driven parent and an anxiety or terror-driven culture. Interaction can only take place when content matches intent. Inappropriate content brings about reaction, not intellectual growth and awareness. Just pure reaction. Anxiety results when the child is forced into mismatched relating of intent and content. Interchange with the matrix and growth of personal power then break down, but the sequential unfolding of maturation goes right on ahead. The child's ability to interact falls more and more behind, and more energy must then go into compensation. The young person's intelligence is still back there trying to make the first matrix functional. Finally, there is a breakdown in the mind-brain balance, which was designed to be smoothly synchronous. When the capacity for abstract creativity and pure thought does not develop properly, the solution is not to try to force earlier and earlier abstract thinking, as we now try to do. Rather, we must provide for full dimensional interaction with the living earth without allowing abstract ideas to intercede or obscure, so that a sufficient concrete structure may be built from which abstractions can arise. Our 3 billion year heritage is truly magnificent. The promise given us is infinite in scope. But this biological plan must be nurtured, and in order to do so, we must first recognize that such a plan exists and then learn something of what the plan is about. We knew about this plan when we were around 6 years old, and a great excitement, a longing, and joyful anticipation filled us. Something else happened, of course, and even as it happened, we knew intuitively that it was all wrong. This primary knowing of excitement, longing, and great joyful anticipation got covered up by anxiety conditioning, which was so deep and so pervasive, so ingrained, and yet so continually reinforced and amplified on every hand that the deep knowing has been lost to us. The intent of this book is to uncover this knowing in you and to verify and reassure your knowing. We must rekindle our knowing of a personal power that can flow with the power of all things and never be exhausted. We must rekindle a faith in a life system that is our matrix and designed to support us. Only through faith in yourself, faith in your very own life, can you respond to a new life given you, either your offspring or your own lost self, according to the needs of that new life. Paradoxically, for most of us parents, it may only be through response to our children that this faith can be recovered, because only the child expresses it openly. We are in a kind of double bind. Only through faith can we open to the life processes within us and make a proper response of nurturing our children. And only through that response can we again open to and reclaim our faith and our own personal power. What we will find is that only by our initial actions, in which we act as though we had personal power and knew what to do, can we in fact activate that power and knowing. Understanding follows knowing, and knowing results from actions, and proper actions can follow only some deep intuitive hunch that bypasses ordinary thinking. Our first step is then to consider that it just might be possible that nature knew what she was doing when she devised this 3 billion year old developmental plan. This is the end of episode 2. Including chapter 1 and chapter 2. Thank you for listening.